My guest today is Adam von Busker. He is a writer. He has essays in Palladium. He's also a prolific Twitter poster on two accounts, which are linked below. One of them is MC America. He's also a knife producer, a hunting knife craftsman, which you should also check out. Today, we speak about a myriad of topics. The first one is collapse. Should we fear it? When's it coming? Then the possibility of revolution. There is also a lot about the desire for the frontier, homesteading, the return to the land, the return back from the land. We also speak about migration towards the cities, the increasing trend to urbanization, and a lot more. And in our second half of the conversation, the last part of our conversation, which is going to be on Subsecond Patreon, link below, we speak about Red Caesar, the possibility of a powerful monarchic, incredible force rolling over the West or over the U.S. We also speak about universal progressivism or our increased sensitivity to any sort of violence and how that plays out in politics and in our social life, sensitivity to risk as well. And we also speak about the death of adult nightlife, plus Adam's recommendation of Subversive Thinkers. So I think this was a really wonderful conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. I think one of the more salient, interesting things that you've been chatting about online recently is this concept of collapse, of, you know, the imminent something happening. It's kind of in the air. There are a lot of people online who kind of instinctually think that something terminal is going to happen to society. There are a few contenders of theories of how this might happen. Inflation will consume the economy. You know, nuclear war is always a classic. Demographic collapse, obviously. There's all sorts of AI singularity, many, many ways in which we could, you know, have a more thunderous or slow demise. I wonder how you relate to this concept of collapse, and what do you think is more likely than not? I mean, I'm not expecting you to make, you know, serious predictions about what might happen, because it is a pretty strange information infrastructure that we have to deal with. But how do you relate to this idea that things are coming to an end?
Well, first of all, you know, I think that one of the things that's spoken of the least in terms of collapse is actually nuclear war. And I think that that's probably the most concrete and plausible mechanism that would lead to the kind of collapse that people fantasize about. And as I said, I don't really think that that's a primary focus. You know, for some reason, people want to believe that something different or much lesser, you know, will lead to dramatic collapse. And obviously, I don't really have the knowledge to you know, pontificate about the you know, the likelihood of nuclear war. But that's kind of been one of my framing points, is that something on the level of an asteroid strike, nuclear war. My big thing is, and this was not something I believed earlier in life, but the more I learned, the more I saw how durable certain aspects of modern life are. And that was kind of, there's a feeling that these complex systems, which of course are complex, there's a feeling that they're incredibly fragile. But if you look at complexity in a slightly different way, it's like a web or a net, where when one strand becomes disruptive, you have very rapid adaptation, you know, and reallocation of resources. And we've seen this in the world as we watch current events. We see how the system dealt with, you know, the situation in Yemen with the shipping being disrupted. Obviously, it put a cost on things. It's not good. And it's a black eye for the U.S., but the larger world system dealt with that very, very quickly. And we also saw predictions that we'd have, you know, massive famine due to the disruption in Ukraine, you know, the problem with the shipping. And once again, we get these predictions, and sooner or later, a prediction of doom is going to be right. But that doesn't really imply that these predictions have any quality. Because if you just continuously make incorrect predictions of an imminent disaster, eventually you're going to look really smart, but it's just, it's a stopped clock effect. It's just robotically predicting disasters, which the great majority of the time, there's an adaptive response that prevents it.
Yeah. I mean, how do you assess the risk of kind of ideologically kind of starting revolutions rather than the collapse? Because a lot of people think, okay, you know, there's going to be like an EMP or something that's, you know, kind of extremely disruptive, like an exogenous force. But at the same time, what we have as a wild card at the moment is this, you know, it's the internet, where you have mimetic forces of a might that has never been seen historically, just kind of ravaging through people's minds, occupying 5, 10, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, 1,000 hours of their time every month. And, you know, I wonder if you think that there is enough kind of cinder for a revolution from this perspective.
I think that the heavily online effect, it lends itself more to what I would think of as passive dysfunction than any type of conventional, you know, revolution activity. If you look at revolutionary activity, you look at Maoism, you look at these different movements, it's typically involving in the modern day. It involves, you know, these immiserated, you know, third world peasants that have extremely little to lose. If their physical living conditions are rough enough that it's comprehensible for them to, you know, endure the hardships and the sufferings of a physical actual revolution. But it seems to me that the danger of the internet immersion is really quite different, because also revolution is sometimes led by, you know, a middle-aged, you know, failed intellectual type of person. But the rank and file's got to be young. You know, it's got to be young people. If the facts that we see today is that there's a retreat by young people from almost any type of physical activity. I mean, a lot of 20-year-olds say, and I haven't seen this personally, but, you know, they claim they've never driven a car. You know, they claim they've never dated. And to me, is this a revolutionary population? It just doesn't seem plausible on a physical, aggressive, armed level. Your Americans, who are sometimes the most radicalized and actually have the, you know, the real world focus for these things, are typically often 55, 60 years old. You know, if you think about your angry, you know, heavily armed boomer, but once again, does the moment ever come? Would be my question. Or does that cohort really just age towards being elderly and the moment never comes, which would be my prediction in the developed world, certainly.
Yeah, I think, what's happening and what's kind of showing up for me on the horizon is not very promising. I see a lot of people kind of clamoring for some sort of revolt. You know, the idea that, the fact that inflation is eating up wealth and, you know, all these narratives about the impoverished millennials, impoverished Gen Z, I think that's probably partially true, especially, you know, given purchasing power it doesn't bite in many categories like housing and things like that, like it used to. But at the same time, I feel like it's a little bit overblown, just in terms of the actual data. I mean, if you look at the actual wealth statistics related to millennials and Zoomers, it's not, I mean, maybe the feeling on the ground is that, okay, you know, the boomers are doing better, but they're also in their 50s. Obviously they're doing better. They have homes, they have all sorts of resources that you're not going to have in your 20s. That's just the reality of it. But yeah, it's just, I don't necessarily know if people realize how to separate the story about the world from the world that they're experiencing, because they're experiencing more of the story than the actual world.
Yeah, and I think that's the issue, and really the home ownership thing with the homes, I think it's a stand-in for a much larger dissatisfaction. Okay, so, you know, I'm 43, So, you know, when I'm thinking back to my own, you know, earlier years, I'm thinking around the turn of the 21st century. Okay. When I was, you know, 20, 21, you know, 2001 era. And what's interesting, I saw a thing online the other day that the Generation Z, the Zoomers, age adjusted, they have the highest home ownership rate of any generation. And what was interesting to me thinking back was when I was that age, I never remember anyone caring about owning a home. Like, I never remember like 21-year-old guys talking about what a house cost because we didn't want a house. Like, we would live in a house with like four other guys and party. You know, we would live in apartments. It wasn't even a thing. And that's kind of one interesting thing is now you've got these young people, young single men who are like deeply concerned about housing. And I think it's a stand-in for other things. To them, it's security. And also, I think it goes to the very legitimate and very, very real social problems that generation is facing. So it's like they feel like if they had the house, you know, with the white picket fence, I mean, unconsciously, you imagine that you're going to have a social life that reflects that. You think you're going to have a family. You think you're going to successfully, you know, meet a woman. And what they don't know is that in the past, it really didn't work that way. You met the partner first on almost every case. And then you went about obtaining these sort of middle class, to the extent you ever did, these middle class trappings. So I think the houses and they are very expensive now. That's a reality. I do think there's a lot of anxiety about other problems that is spoken through the vehicle of the housing anxiety. Maybe that's a way to put it.
Yeah, I think that's very correct. Because, yeah, like you said, you know, 20-something year olds in the 90s, I mean, obviously, housing was cheaper. I admit that. Yeah. But it wasn't their main anxiety. And I think it also lives, you know, this. We used to have a story about men being, you know, marriage shy. You know, the idea was that they didn't want to really get pinned down. And now, at least in online discourse, the story is flipped. A lot of young men are kind of these, like, temporarily embarrassed potential patriarchs of a family of 10. They're itching to build an empire, have a billion children, and, you know, live the trad life. And it does feel to me like, okay, there is a certain obvious yearning for something there, but it kind of is left to run amok in this story realm where, because people are not connected to what actually is, I think this is reflected as well in kind of the homesteading movement. Now there people are kind of coming back from the land, from the homesteading movement. A lot of people have sold, you know, their apartments in the city to go raise chickens and sell, I don't know, tallow butter or whatever, soap and things like that. And now, obviously, those are not viable businesses. There's a certain business aspect of farming that's very brutal and very harsh, and it's not really surprising that, you know, like huge farms with economies of scale are the ones who are actually making money and farming. And so, you know, people come back from the land now, and there's a lot of phenomena like this where there's a certain fantasy of a life that might have existed in the past that you've been robbed of. And then obviously there's so many communities now online that allow you to live out that fantasy, to commiserate with friends or people who, you know, have similar aspirations. And it speaks to something obviously true, but I think that the layers upon layers of story that we're allowed to add online, and the cult that, you know, everyone, you know, is feeding into online, makes it a bit harder to break out of, makes it a bit harder to actually solve these problems, to actually go after it. And, you know, because you build these, you know, cathedrals of imagination of what could be and what was, what should be. And then the reality is that actually in real life, a lot of these things are really difficult. They're difficult and they weren't easy for your grandfather. And a lot of the times your grandfather was doing them because he had to. There are fewer things that you have to do nowadays. And the things that he had to do were tough. And he just kind of grit his teeth through them. And I feel like there's fewer and fewer experiences like that now. In a way, we have to be grateful, but at the same time, it's robbing us of something. And I think that's kind of what people are responding to.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting topic because, you know, one of the little online words that it just keeps coming up, and I use it myself, it's kind of silly, the statement of LARPing. You know, everything's pretend. But at a certain point, that in a way that wasn't true in the past, that becomes inescapable, because right now you have the option, you know, as an American who's, you know, even vaguely physically and mentally able, you know, you can go in a lot of places, and I know people basically doing this, maybe not your top cities, but even a lot of metro areas, you can, you know, we've got the real minimum wage is approaching $20 an hour, okay, for someone who's mentally and physically not in the absolute lowest category, like just someone who can lift and move an item. Like if I just, you know, randomly walked in a construction place where I, you know, I've done construction before, you're going to be in the low 20s just because I'm physically fit. All right. So in a lot of cities, a tip like Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, a middle American city, you can do almost any job. You can get a one bedroom apartment. You can get a two bedroom apartment. It's got, you know, hot water. It's got heat. It's got air conditioning. You can afford food. And that wasn't the case in 1920. You know, people were driven to do things out of true desperation. You know, like you read about the Okies, is the homestead era, and the Okies are kind of a favorite topic of mine, you know. So, you know, these people in many cases, you know, the Jodes, like, you know, John Steinbeck wrote about, these people weren't trying to live out like a aspiration or an identity. I mean, they didn't have food to eat. They walked or hitchhiked to California. I mean, their lives were direct, and even at above that level. I mean, even like normal, you know, my ancestors were farmers, you know, and there were things that you absolutely had to do. And that was, it wasn't an identity. They didn't decide they wanted to be a farmer, you know, and move to the country. So most people were living out a very direct survival lifestyle until really very recently. But now it becomes a question of your status, where you're, what neighborhood you're in. Are you in the right neighborhood? It's not about eating food. But that's very uncomfortable for people. They like to talk about their lives in terms of struggle, as if it's truly, you know, I can't make a living in America. But when you break it down, it becomes usually, unless you're really unfortunate, I'm not saying there aren't people that are truly unfortunate. I'm talking about your middle class, healthy, you know, your average person. It's a search for identity. And it's like you can't get away from it because, you know, even if you want to go, I'm going to go be a founder. Well, a lot of that is motivated not because that's how you're going to eat, but because you want to be seen that way. You want to be in that social circle. And it's the same with, you want to be an organic farmer. You want to be the guy who, you know, introduces himself that way. So it's, I don't know, there's no great answer I have, but it so much is a search now for identity.
Yeah. And in a way you can't really get away from the status game. I think it was almost existentially important for our ancestors as well, but it just was played out in such a different way where, because you had closer knit communities, your status was essentially, yeah, the ticket to actually gaining material possessions or being protected by the other males in the tribe or having access to mates. There are all sorts of things. And now even status is such a far away thing. And like you mentioned, you know, this fact that we've kind of been stripped of hardship, I think I see this playing out a lot, even in how people relate to religion. Like it feels like it's very hard for people to access religion, myself included, on a level that is as visceral and as immediate as it used to be for example, my grandparents' generation, where, you know, hardships like, you know, 5 out of 8 children survived. You held your dead babies in your hands. People were, you know, having serious crises, dying of hunger, war. My grandparents, my father was quite old. He suffered the hunger after the Second World War when he was a child. He had nutritional deficiencies, like all sorts of bone diseases, pellagra, all sorts of issues that now it's like you watch documentaries from the early 20th century and then, you know, the horrors of war and things like that. But, you know, these things are one generation away from me. And, you know, they were acute in a way and they informed your view of the world in a way that is just not accessible to a lot of people in the first world, and even in the second world. I mean, I'm Romanian. I live in Romania now, and you know, things are pretty pretty calm and pretty cozy here too. And it's just not. It's very strange. And in a way, I think that's the yearning that a lot of people have. They want to access these states, but the price to pay to actually do it is a bit too steep for a lot of people. Like, you can essentially go out, and I think you had a really interesting post about this. You can go off the grid. You can, you know, be a frontiersman nowadays if you want to. You know, you can opt out of a lot of things. You can just unabomber it. You know, it is possible. And you lay it out quite clearly how one could do it and where you can go. And I'll link to the post in the show notes. But I think, is there a way that, you can opt out of things? Do you think people have the motivation? I mean, what percentage of the population do you think would actually be able to live out their fantasies of escape from modernity?
Boy. I guess that the problem really is the escape part. I mean, if you physically want to, you know, live in an odd way, there's definitely places you can do that. I mean, you can buy land in West Texas. Everyone says, oh, they're going to come after you for zoning. No, there actually is no zoning. I mean, you can do, you know, you can go out there and build a hut, and, you know, people say, well, they'll take your kids away. But, you know, I travel a lot in the West. There's a lot of areas where you'll see quite a few people living heavily off the grid. The great majority of them have not had their kids taken away. You know, I'm not saying it can't happen, but yeah, so physically you can do all that, but I mean, how do you escape the larger social world of modernity? That's a much different question. And one misconception a lot of people have is that, you know, like if they live in a more remote or a more rural area of the United States, that the social realities are going to be profoundly different. I mean, every kid in America has, unless, you know, specifically restricted, they have access to the cell phones. Okay, so they're on the same internet that you're on, the same internet I'm on. And there isn't really like even another country where that isn't the case. You know, I go on to X. I've got, just as an example, and these are actually very interesting to me, I have a number of mutuals in Somalia, right? So you're ignorant person, they think Somalia is like the absolute end of the universe. They would think that there isn't electricity there. They would think there isn't internet there. They would think of it almost as like another planet. But of course, you know, that isn't even true. I mean, it's certainly a country has a lot of dangerous problems, but that's just an extreme example that I have, I don't know, 5 or 6 English fluent Somalian mutuals. So, you know, the world, we all increasingly live in the information sense in the same world. And what's strange is that contrary to what people believed earlier, the physical world hasn't become all the same. You know, you look at stuff from the 90s and they were talking about, well, there's nowhere adventurous to travel anymore. Everywhere is tame. Well, the world in 2024 is not tame. There's infinite places you really shouldn't go, okay? There's large place parts of, you know, Mexico is right south of us. You know, they build the Chevy Silverado truck. But there's large areas of Mexico where you're you'd be very well advised to not go. Well, that's the part of, so the physical universality of modernity didn't happen. If anything, in a certain physical sense, the world has become bigger. Parts of it are more inaccessible. Parts of it are more dangerous. But the mental space has come together in almost like a science fiction aspect where everyone is together in the same mental space. And I think that's a big challenge that people are going to find, you know, with efforts at homesteading or even efforts to go to foreign countries, you know, efforts to build a cabin in the wilderness. So these physically exotic things are available to you, but how do you, or do you even want to mentally detach from what's largely becoming, you know, a single world mind?
Yeah, I think it was an interesting anecdote that someone posted recently, and that they had this idea of, you know, going back to the land, and they're kind of more of a like a white nationalist persuasion, and I think they moved to Appalachia or someplace fairly remote. They were quite shocked of, you know, the fact that they didn't really have much in common with the people there, that they were not possessed by any sort of kind of spiritual affinity to the white cause, or they were not really slightly interested in anything. They were just kind of much more in survival mode, less in intellectual mode than anyone in the cities. And, you know, it felt quite repulsive to them that, okay, this, you know, I thought these were my people, but they were not. And it's, you know, even though the color scheme was correct, you know, they're similar, you know, similar route, but still it didn't work out. And I feel like, you know, that's probably the destiny of a lot of these ideas where, okay, you presume that you have a lot in common with people. But a lot of times, like, for example, I have maybe more in common with people who live in different parts of the U.S. because this is kind of the intellectual, you know, space that I spend a lot of time on, unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, it's useful for the podcast at least. You know, and a lot of times that gets me in trouble here because I have to, you know, I have to be a person here as well. I have, you know, I have to be in real life here in my little mommy groups. And sometimes I'm a little bit alien because I spend too much time in my little corner of the internet. And it is weird. It's in a way, it's kind of, it's alienating you from what's there, and it's making you connect to things that, you know, maybe are not necessarily that useful to you. I mean, I personally don't know where I stand to that, but I thought that little, you know, vignette of the disappointed white nationalist is quite interesting. He's going to come on the podcast as well very soon, but it's a very, you know, probably not a unique situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think I know what you're talking about, and not where I live now, but in the past, I'm familiar with more or less the kind of setting where he probably moved, expecting it to be vastly different than it was. And yeah, it's simply not what these people would expect in a, for example, you know, white nationalists folks, and they like to look like the percent that's white in an area. So there's these areas that are 100% white, 99% white. Okay, if you actually, there's two things that crush that effort. Number one is that if you actually go there, the kids listen to rap. Okay, the kids are on phone. No, I'm serious. The kids are, you know, they're on phones, they're on Spotify, they're listening to rap, they're totally plugged in to YouTube, to rap. I mean, there's nothing there which you think is going to be there. You know, this, you know, thing where they're, I don't know, out like doing some folksy thing or whatever, the kids are just like kids anywhere else. And it doesn't matter how physically remote you are from a city, it's almost the opposite. And the other thing is that a lot of these people that are very into white identity, they've grown up in an economically segregated suburb. So when they say what white people are like, they're speaking of an experience where the socioeconomically bottom 20% or even 50% was totally removed from their experience. So they have no idea when you go into a community, a rural community that is all white, well, everybody's white. People on welfare are white. The criminals are white. You see, so their view that a white person is essentially equivalent to an upper middle class is completely devastated because they witness that when you're not economically segregating, you have the entire spectrum. And that's very dislocating to them, you know, to see the, you know, the 20% that was specifically excluded from the environments they were living in before. And they never even really considered that those people existed. And I think that, and you see what he says about that, but I think that's going to be a large part of it too.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you had an interesting anecdote on your account as well about the migration to cities. And this is something I see, and it's quite shocking how fast this is happening here in Romania. You mentioned Albania, but Romania is just the same. You know, the movement of subcontinental Nepalese, Sri Lankan immigrants to kind of these second tier countries like Romania, because there is no workforce left here. Like, because a lot of the people from here have moved to Western Europe, or some even to America. So it's really interesting how there's kind of, you know, urbanization is happening at every level, but there are tiers. There are I don't know, you kind of have to graduate from one country to another to qualify for the Olympics, which is the US. I mean, unfortunately, whatever you'd like to think about it, but that's where people want to end up. I thought that was interesting, and the fact that, you know, this is obviously not just happening in Romania, but this has happened shockingly fast. Like, this was not a thing 2 years ago. Now every Uber driver, Uber itself is a bit of a, you know, urbanization phenomenon. But yeah, any sort of delivery service, every person is from the subcontinent in one way or another. It's quite, yeah, overnight.
Well, that's incredible. Because I at this point in my life, I don't have a lot of opportunity to actually travel. So I'm kind of relieved that someone who's closer to the scene actually goes along with that take, because I read a lot, but sometimes obviously I have to opine on things I haven't seen with my own eyes. So that's pretty interesting that really, you know, because I did that. That's really a solid, you know, observation that you've made. But that seems to be the way it works. And in one of my articles, it's an old, certainly a word that used to be used more, but I like the concept of a metropole, which is like one of the world cities that draws everyone in. And it's interesting because, of course, there's London, there's Paris, there's Toronto. Just to go into some non-American, but, you know, Toronto and New York City are in a way the same place. I mean, that's the people are seem to be trying to get into these core world cities, you know, these Western cities. And it's interesting because it really is an urban movement. I mean, there's large, so we always think of everyone wants to get to the United States. There's large parts of the United States that attract no immigrants, the rural areas. That's not what they're looking for at all. It's more like a ranking of cities that they want to be into. And most of these cities that they're trying to go to, the class A destinations, most of them are in the United States, but they're not all in the United States. It's not fundamentally, you know, that they're just trying to get somewhere in the U.S. They're not. I mean, there's a few motel owners, a few restaurant owners that will go, to small cities in Iowa. But really the movement, yeah, it's essentially an urban movement. And it looks like there's almost a limit to a country's ability to attract immigration, because your basic dynamic is that every human being, almost every human being, wants to move to somewhere it's got a higher per capita GDP than where they currently live, and maybe even more keenly, they want to move somewhere that consumes more barrels of oil. So if you want to understand, you know, what country's going to attract, what country's going to lose, you can really almost look at just oil or energy usage. So you see, Albania is supposedly a famously poor country in Europe, right? But your subcontinental that comes from, you know, Bihar or something to Albania has instantly increased the amount of oil that they consume. And that seems to pretty much predict the movement. And you even see this with once they get to, you know, a migrant comes into Spain. Okay, Spain is a big improvement from Africa, but their ultimate goal tends to be to reach Germany, which is, once again, more highly industrialized, higher per capita GDP. I mean, to be a country so poor that you don't at least attract the desire for immigration, you have to be really, really poor. I mean, you would have to be so poor that almost no one in the world is increasing their consumption level, you know, by coming into your zone. So that's why we see that, you know, Albania and Romania, you know, pulling immigrants. This is a funny one. Iran has an immigration problem. They have a big problem with illegal immigration from Afghanistan. It's just like, you know, Mexico and the United States. They're countries that are next to each other. You know, Iran is approaching like a southern, it's approaching a Balkan or a southern European, depending on how you measure it. Since they're under sanctions, it's hard to measure. But, you know, their economy is approaching a southern European level. So, of course, it draws immigration from Central Asia. So it's pretty, you know, the whole world wants to be on the move other than they hit like a razor wire fence. It pretty much seems to be what it amounts to.
It is interesting, though, that because we are increasing our consumption of oil and, you know, becoming kind of leaning towards a first world status here as well, there are people from the West coming back after having gained, you know, experience in the West, knowing how to run restaurants and do all the things that you learn on the job. And at the same time, a lot of the workers that come here, you know, this is kind of a second world country. I would say maybe 5 or 10% of them actually want to settle here. Probably a bigger chunk of them would really love to settle in Western Europe, which is still developed. But a lot of them are essentially kind of typical guest workers, where you work here 5-10 years, you build your house back in Nepal. You know, people tend to hire people who have families so that they're more incentivized to, you know, move back or send their money back and be more stable, and not, you know, be risky and run away and, you know, not hold down a job. So I think it's an interesting time for countries like Romania, where you do kind of have this steady increase in prosperity, but you also don't have the pressure that mass immigration puts on you, but you also can benefit from the labor of people who want to work here, but because, you know, you're not like, you know, you're not London, you're not, you know, one of the metropolises, you're not that desirable. I think it's actually, even though I'm more of the, you know, a bit of an immigration skeptic, I don't necessarily think mass immigration is good for any country, you know, uncontrolled mass immigration especially, but I think Eastern Europe at the moment is in a bit of a kind of a Goldilocks zone for its own development. Yeah, I think it's a good place to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were at a higher GDP standard, you would see a lot more people trying to stay. You know,
yeah,
I absolutely think that, yeah, beyond a certain level of development, you probably would have perhaps more problems. And, you know, that brings me into one of my other big topics I've been into recently. It kind of vaguely comes off of that, is that, and this is one of the things I think has been really overlooked in literature about development, is that in today's world, you don't really have to develop all the way. What the question of what it actually does to come up to, like, you know, a United States GDP is kind of, you know, unless you want to create large armies or go to space or something, the question of what developing beyond the level of, say, you know, Romania actually does for the individuals is kind of obscure, because in today's world, we can be very healthy. We can, like, for example, your Greek lives longer than your American. Why? Is it because they're richer? Well, no, it's they have what they need. It doesn't, you don't need, you know, a 10-lane freeway to live to be 90 years old. You know, you need enough to eat. And there's certain basic medications that are, you know, were developed in the highly developed countries, but at this point are pretty well generic. You know, you need a certain level. And it's less obvious than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago, that it's critical to go to, you know, high GDPs for human well-being. And we're even seeing that in Africa now. If you look at even the least developed countries on Earth, you know, the life expectancy has gone through the roof. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, development failed in Africa because they don't have automobiles. They don't have, you know, their actual monetary consumption has actually stayed relatively flat for a long period of time. But at the same time that their sort of conventional development has been relatively flat, you know, you've seen the human well-being go up a great deal, which has, of course, led to a population boom, which that's a different topic. So it's kind of interesting as to why would Romania need, you know, or want even to reach the development level of the UK? It's not as obvious as people would think it is, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, especially given that, you know, global trade allows you to piggyback a little bit off of things like you mentioned, you know, medical advances. And essentially, that's kind of what you have here now. Like, I was actually researching some medical insurance now for my family recently, like private insurance. We have kind of an NHS type system here, but you don't really necessarily want to be using it all the time. It's not very high quality. Plus, you know, wait is long. You pay in time. That's generally how it is with state systems. It is interesting. Like they offer surgeries in Turkey. They offer surgeries in France, and I think in Greece as well, or something like that. So this is essentially most of the operating places. You get a kind of a selection of all these fairly kind of global, or at least European places where you get to do your surgeries. And we're essentially kind of, you know, piggybacking off of the fact that these places have really good surgeons. At the same time, other people's insurance systems offer, you know, dental care in Romania, because we're good at dental care, and Hungary as well is also kind of famous for, you know, dental tourism. I guess it's, what's that, comparative advantage. Really, you know, are getting used to the fact that this is just the way it is now.
Well, yeah, and it's a great example there with the medical care, but a lot of things really work that way. As long as, like I said, outside of a nuclear war or an asteroid or something that truly, you know, disrupts systems, a lot of things operate on comparative advantage. Because here's a great example. Every country in the world, as we know, has an airport, right? You can fly in. It's a modern airport. There's air traffic control. And this includes very low developed countries. I mean, you can get on a Delta flight and go to essentially, you know, any country in the world. You're not landing on a dirt runway with cattle walking around or anything. It's very normal. And I'm not a technical expert, but I think if you looked into that, you'd find that this system, it runs on sort of portable technology. Okay, so the plane is an Airbus created in France, right? Well, the plane is flying in between, you know, Oman and Sudan, right? But it's an Airbus plane. So it embodies that very, very high first world technology into a form that goes everywhere. And I think that if you really researched it, the same would probably be true with like the radars, the air traffic controls. You know, when you're coming down into Khartoum, that module, and I'm not an engineer, I'm just speaking loosely, the modules in the planes, the modules in the control tower, all of this is probably going to be either from the United States or the EU. I mean, China's really just now getting in, I think, to the world of passenger planes. But this technology has been taken out of these, you know, very limited, most developed areas. And now it's been taken portably. And it's kind of like a black box thing. The people that are operating it effectively don't need to understand the circuitry inside this Airbus jet. You know, they've been trained to operate it just like I drive a car and don't know how to rebuild the, you know, engine electronic control module. In food works the same way. You constantly get this narrative of this in this country can't feed themselves. Well, I mean, you know, wheat and corn is, you know, pumped onto ships. It goes everywhere in the world and it's very, very cheap. Oh, it's can be bought by almost any country that can generate any kind of income. And so the, you know, the comparative advantage of, you know, Iowa corn, which is probably the cheapest calories on the planet, is accessible to every country, just like you can go have a surgery in Turkey from Romania. That kind of goes back to the durability of things, is that a lot of this stuff, you know, people like to say, well, Egypt, why it's going to collapse, it's going to starve. Well, I mean, right now they're 45% obese, okay? And the Mediterranean Sea is not an infinitely difficult barrier to the transport of food, you know, from less populated countries that have more arable land. I mean, short of the entire system that we're talking over that puts gas in our cars collapsing, it's strangely difficult to think of an imminent mechanism that's going to cause these things to fail.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a layer to this, which I don't necessarily know how much weight to put on. It's this idea of the crisis of competence, which I think is made a little bit worse, not because a lot of people see it as, okay, this is, you know, wokeness gone amok, you know, standards are dropping everywhere. No one's really been being actually tested on, you know, essential competence, like, you know, keeping the electrical grid alive and, you know, being, you know, the engineer on call for essential systems. I think the bigger problem is what we were discussing at the beginning of our conversation, the fact that, you know, people are very much checked out. Like a lot of these jobs have a certain degree of difficulty, responsibility. Probably the payoff is decent as well, but it's not, I mean, these were high status jobs back in our parents' generation, our grandparents, you know, being like lead engineer at Factory X. Is it still that high status? Are young people checked out, or are they checked in enough to want to be lead engineer at the factory? Are they competent enough to be doing this? You know, I don't necessarily know how to evaluate this. I hope they are, but at the same time, I could also imagine that they might not want to be doing these types of jobs anymore.
I hope you enjoyed this shorter version of the Subversive Podcast. For the full version, for the full archive, and for pretty much everything I've written in the last 3 years, please do head to the Substack link in the show notes, or to Patreon if you just want the audio version of the podcast. Thank you so much for your support. This is literally what keeps the lights on, the sparkly, twinkly lights that I got for the podcast, and puts food on the table of my children, multiple. So thank you so much for your kind support, and see you next time.